Today is the feast of St. Thomas More. So on the occasion in a parish where the patron saint of the parish falls on a Sunday, it trumps the Sunday and we get to celebrate that day. So that's why I'm in red, deacon is in red, because St. Thomas More was a martyr, and red for the blood shed by the martyrs. And also, you might notice that the dedication candles are lit. We only light those two times a year, on the anniversary of the dedication of the church, which was in October, so we'll be doing it again in October, but also on the feast day of the patron saint of the parish. So we're all kind of familiar with St. Thomas More. And I learned something interesting this morning. You never stop learning. It's so great. Even though he was in the 16th century, lived and died in the 16th century, he wasn't canonized until 1935. And normally, canonization requires several miracles. But Pope Pius XI waived that requirement. There were no miracles attributed to him, but he thought it was important to have a lay person be canonized for people in the 20th century, for all the things that we face, all the trials and stresses, and you know, they were living in between the First and the Second World Wars, and World War II was looming right around the corner, and you know, the world was just kind of in chaos, and the Pope thought that people really needed a model of sainthood, and a model of someone who really didn't want to be a martyr, who wasn't living in a monastery, who wasn't living a particularly religious life, but was a family man. He had four children. He was a lawyer. He's the patron saint of lawyers, by the way, and we know they need the help. And but it came to pass that he had to stand his convictions all the way to the death. Henry VIII was king, and he wanted to divorce his first wife, and that was against church law. And St. Thomas More was a canon lawyer and a civil lawyer, both. He knew both of those systems of law. And his conscience just wouldn't let him go along with the king. And there were other sycophants who did, including the archbishop, and you know, they were going to go along with Henry VIII. But Thomas More was so highly respected by the community that Henry figured he needed Thomas More on his side too. And so he was imprisoned in the Tower and eventually beheaded. So he wrote a book called Utopia, and that's why our parish hall is called Utopia. And he was imprisoned before his death in the Tower, and that's why we have the Tower Room. So we kind of live the life of Thomas More, and we have this wonderful statue of him over there that was carved by a K-State student back at the time this church was built, back in 1990. So these dedication candles, there are 12 of them, and there are also underneath them 12 crosses. And when a church is dedicated, it calls to mind in the physical body of the church and the building. Of course, we're the church, not the building, but the building becomes a symbol of the body of Christ. And so the 12 crosses symbolize the 12 tribes of Israel, and the 12 candles symbolize the 12 apostles of the Lamb. Why? Jesus very intentionally chooses 12 people to be his apostles, because Jesus saw his mission as reuniting the 12 tribes of Israel. You know, Israel was, you might say, it was God's experiment in the human community. God called this people to himself, formed them in the wilderness, and tried to show them through the law how to live divine life in a human form in this world, and to live and act and love like God. And of course, they were successful in some ways and failed in other ways. But ultimately, it was a failure. And so in the incarnation, God takes on human flesh to finish that project, you might say, to bring it to completion. And Jesus says, I haven't come to destroy the law, I've come to fulfill the law. And what was the law intended to do? It was intended to draw these people to God's own self and make them his family and encourage them and grace them to live like God, to bring the kingdom on earth through grace. And so Jesus does that, and of course at great cost. It cost him his life. But the irony is that his death is not a real lasting death because of his resurrection. And so a whole new creation has happened. The church is the new Israel. So the 12 tribes are still present in us because we're the fulfillment of that. We're the new Israel, the new Jerusalem. And so this new creation has happened. In that second reading, Paul reminds the Corinthians that everything has changed now. This is a new creation. God is still active. Creation wasn't just something that happened eons ago. It's ongoing. And we're being recreated anew every day. In that gospel, Jesus calms the wind and the sea. And in biblical terms, throughout the Old Testament, wherever there's water controlled, it's God creating. So the separation of the sea from the dry land in the book of Genesis is about God controlling the waters, separating so that humans have a safe place to dwell, and the limits of the sea have been set by God's creative act. And then when Moses touches his staff to the Red Sea and it parts, that's God recreating, creating something new, the possibility for freedom from slavery in Egypt and entry into the promised land. And when Joshua takes that same staff and touches the Jordan River, it dams up, stops flowing, and they cross on dry land. These are all symbols of God's creative activity that's ongoing, that happens throughout history. And so when Jesus calms the sea, he's controlling the water, and his disciples recognize, who is this that the wind and the sea obey him? But Jesus says to them, why are you afraid? Have you no faith? We live in the tension between the already and the not yet of the kingdom. We're very aware of our sinfulness, and yet we're also aware through faith and the scriptures and the liturgy and our church teaching, we're aware that we're called to something new, to a new creation, to a kingdom that's beyond what this earth can offer. And so in that tension, we live our lives conscious of the struggle, conscious of our fear, and yet knowing that we shouldn't be afraid. And we allow the Eucharist, the gospel, to tell us over and over again, because we need to hear this, that there really isn't ultimately any reason to be afraid, because God is always on our side. You know, the church building is sometimes likened to a ship. The main body of the church is called the nave, from the Latin navis, sea, or boat. And this is the stern. And Jesus is asleep on a cushion, and the cushion is the altar. And Jesus is asleep at the stern. And in the same way that those fearful disciples awakened Jesus, our gathering here and praying awakens him. But the irony is, we're the ones who are waking up. Jesus is always present, and he's always alert and awake. We're the ones who are asleep. Our fear drives us to sleep to a kind of death. Fear controls us. It keeps us from God. It draws a curtain, a separation between ourselves and God. And Jesus reminds us in the Eucharist of his presence, and he quietly, calmly, but chidingly says to us, "Why are you afraid? I'm always here. There's no reason for you to fear."